For being on Think Outside the Cage, and we'll be back next week, and thanks a lot, and we'll be at
thank
the
you.
Show. Okay.
Thank you, Gary. Happy
thank
Sunday.
You.
All right. All right. KPFK, Los Angeles.
Welcome to KPFK, established in 1959 on the Pacifica Radio Network, a broadcast service of, by, and for the people. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake. People Power is on your radio.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we bring you the keynote from the two-day event, Progressive Central 2024, held in Chicago August 18th and 19th, just ahead of the Democratic National Convention, to advance progressive solutions to the crises undermining contemporary society and politics, all the things you wanted to hear more of at the convention itself. Progressive Central 2024 was hosted by Progressive Democrats of America in coordination with The Nation magazine, the Arab American Institute, Operation Rainbow Push, and it was held in Chicago at the Chicago Teachers Union Building. Alan Minsky, Executive Director of PDA and former producer of Beneath the Surface, was one of the key organizers, and today brings us the best part, the keynote, opening with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal on the progressive movement within Congress, followed by the keynote speech with Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll then hear Bernie Sanders in dialogue with the nation's John Nichols, and last we hear from Representative Maxwell Frost. All of this when our program returns in just a moment.
We are so lucky to be living in a moment when Pramila Jayapal is one of the most influential leaders in the United States of America and in the House of Representatives. It is a blessing for the society and the world. It could be even all the way down to the salvation of our relationship to this planet that gives us life. Because on every issue that is true and dear to the hearts of progressives and really all good people, and yes, as Cenk said, the majority of Americans, for sure, Pramila Jayapal fights for it. And she not only fights for it, she does it with about as much political acumen as any member of Congress in the history of this country. Please welcome Representative Pramila Jayapal. Yeah, but you have a heart out, so go for it.
Progressives, hello, how are you? Are you ready to win this? Are you ready to win our progressive change? It is so great to be with you, and I want to thank Alan so much for all your leadership and PDA. I was at Rainbow Push last night honoring the great Reverend Jesse Jackson, and I said on stage that Rainbow Push and what Reverend Jackson fought for was the precursor to the modern progressive movement. It was the intersection between racial, economic, and gender justice, and the movement that recognized that working people across this country deserve to be seen, deserve to be heard, deserve to be dignified with rights for everyone. And so I'm grateful to Rainbow Push as well. We have accomplished so much as progressives, and we are getting ready to win in November. And when we do, we will accomplish so much more. And I want to give a special shout out to our Illinois Progressive Caucus members, Jonathan Jackson, Delia Ramirez, Jan Schakowsky, Chewy Garcia, Danny Davis. It's an amazing progressive delegation, and I know you're going to hear from some, but we couldn't do the work we do without these incredible progressive members. So thank you, those of you in Illinois, for sending those folks. Look, I'm an organizer. That's what I did for two decades before I came to Congress. I was actually never interested in being in elected office. I only decided to run for elected office because I realized that we have an organizing opportunity inside Congress, that we have the opportunity to elect organizers who can build power within Congress. And I knew that there were a couple of things that progressives needed to do on the inside as well as the outside. We needed to leverage the power of our voting bloc. We needed to work with the outside movement partners to be strategic and clear in our goals and organized in our approach. And we needed to continue to show that the agenda that we are working for is one that intertwines race, class, and gender. And that these policies are not just progressive, they are actually popular and populist, not just in deep blue districts like mine, but in rural red places, purple places, that these are the things that working people, whatever you want to call these policies, these are the things that working people and poor people across this country need. And so it was really also about making our agenda the mainstream agenda. And as chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, you're going to hear from our founder next. I hear he's stuck in traffic, but you're going to hear from Bernie Sanders, who founded the Progressive Caucus in 1991. We are so grateful to Senator Sanders. He's been an amazing friend and ally to me. And as chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, I've built it from, you know, what it was back then when Bernie was here, which was, he always says it was a couple people that came together and complained about how we weren't getting stuff done. Now we've been able, over the last 8 years, to build a caucus to 100 members, almost 100 members strong. And that is almost half of the Democratic caucus. We're not quite at the 50% mark, but we're almost half of the Democratic caucus. We revamped our rules. What does it mean to be a progressive? How do you stay as a progressive? And we started exercising what I call the courage muscle to actually stand up and push, to use our votes as a block of leverage as far as we possibly can, and to build a cohesive block of votes that we utilized over and over again in the last many years in the toughest of situations, holding the line to stand up for more for our people. And we also showed that progressives can govern. There was always this thought that somehow if you're progressive, you can't govern. And we showed, no, you can govern, and you can get real progress done, and you can get our message out to a broader group. Now, we've also grown our Progressive Caucus PAC from just, when I came in, $300,000 per cycle that we had to help elect progressives across the country, to over $4 million now per cycle that we can help. And we're using it to try and elect more progressives across the country and to defend our incumbents. Now, I'll be clear. We have seen the influence of big money. We have to get big money out of politics. That is the message. We got to do it. We have to make that happen. I would just suggest to you that the reason that all that big money is coming in is precisely because they are afraid of how much we have achieved. And so this cycle, our PAC is proud to support a whole slate of new progressives, including LaMonica Ivor and Sue Altman in New Jersey, Sarah McBride in Delaware, Latifah Simon, Evan Lowe, Laura Friedman, Luz Rivas, Joe Kerr, and Dave Min in California. And we're going to continue to grow that. Now, what is all of this produced? Thanks to progressives, we got things done in the last 4 years that most people thought were impossible just a few years ago. And it's really thanks to this movement, thanks to all of you in the room, thanks to progressives in the House. Thanks to progressives, we held the line to demand that an actual bill get drafted that was called Build Back Better and passed in the House. And that was the language that led to the Inflation Reduction Act. There would have been no Inflation Reduction Act without Build Back Better. And that meant that we made the largest investment ever in taking on climate change, finally standing up to big pharma, and finally making billionaires and big corporations pay just a little bit more in their fair share in taxes. We're going to keep going with that, make them pay their full fair share. It was progressives inside and outside of Congress who pushed for executive action by the Biden-Harris administration to cancel student debt And already the administration has canceled $167 billion, with a B, dollars in student debt for almost 5 million Americans. And that is almost 10% of all the people who have federal student loans have had their debt canceled under this last administration. It was progressives inside Congress who kept pushing to ensure that we got our Justice 40 initiative codified. What does it mean? It means that 40% of our federal investments go to the communities that have been most disproportionately burdened across the country. That is a massive sea change, and it was taking on our institutionally inequitable process. And it was progressives who held the line to demand that CHIPS funding does not go to companies who are doing stock buybacks, and it is progressives who continue to ensure that that is the case. And it has been progressives pushing so hard to rebuild that fragile and diverse coalition now with a working class agenda that sees us all for who we are and fights for our collective dignity to get not just what is our right, my friends, but what we actually deserve as human beings on this earth. And so that is why the Progressive Caucus released a day one agenda for 2025 when we take back the House and the Senate and keep the White House. And we worked closely with the Biden-Harris campaign and now the Harris-Walz campaign to make sure that we are ready to move that agenda forward. It calls for a $300 billion investment in housing because the rent is too damn high. It calls for universal child care where no family pays more than 7% of their income, for humane immigration reform, for getting rid of the filibuster so we codify abortion rights and voting rights and get money out of politics. We raise the minimum wage. We continue to be aggressive on antitrust law so we hold those big corporations accountable. And more investments in climate change. We fight for equality for our LGBTQIA community. We ban assault weapons so our kids can go to school and be safe. And we advance racial justice in every sphere. Now, by the way, we know how to pay for this. We could just make the billionaires and the wealthiest corporations actually pay their fair share of taxes, and we will have plenty of money to do what we need to do. Because, my friends, we do not suffer as a country. We do not suffer from scarcity to be able to invest in these things. We suffer from the greed of a few. We have the money. And it is time. And this is the popular populist economic agenda that is going to get us to victory. And we are seeing that excitement and enthusiasm across the country. We always said that our victory depends on engaging young people and black and brown voters and indigenous and Latino and AAPI voters across this country, working people, poor people. That is our diverse rainbow coalition that is going to take us to victory in November and going to make sure that we get this done, that we make sure we lift up every single person across this country, sees themselves in us, and knows that the government is here to fight for you, to fight for working people and poor people, no matter who you are, across this country. Thank you all very much, and let's get it done.
And with that, I want to introduce to you one of PDA's great partners and probably as close an associate as Reverend Jackson was for Steve Cobble, our founding political director, John Nichols from The Nation. An honor to have you here, John.
Whoa. All right. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Reverend Wilson. 10 years ago, when Senator Bernie Sanders was the most outstanding spokesperson in our Congress on economic and social and racial justice issues, on all these issues, nobody thought he could run for president. Nobody even considered the idea. It was rejected out of hand. Every media pundit, everybody said, oh, no, 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 that cannot be. There was one character living out in Western Massachusetts named Tim Carpenter. And Tim Carpenter said, I think we could get Bernie Sanders to run for president of the United States of America. And I think progressive Democrats of America could do a petition and convince him to make that run. And by God, they did it. And so what you need to understand today at this moment is that Senator Bernie Sanders, supporter of economic and social and racial justice, supporter of a new foreign policy that brings us peace in the Middle East and gets an end to the violence in Gaza, supporter of so many of the causes that matter to the people in this room, Senator Bernie Sanders is coming home. Please welcome the senator from Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you very much. And let me thank PDA for all of the great work they have done. And as I think John indicated, when I was thinking about running for president way back when, actually, there was no organization out there stronger in pushing me forward than PDA. So I want to thank you very much for that. And I brought this young lady up here because I want you to know that she is doing an extraordinary job in the Congress as the most well-organized human being in the history of humanity. You know, we started the Progressive Caucus in the House when I was elected in 91, and we had five members. Under Pramila, what do you got now, 100?
Almost
100. Almost 100. That's the difference. That's the difference being a good organizer and me. All right, thank you for what you do. I just want to say a few words and thank you all for your activism, in many cases for many years. I think the great crisis facing our country is that we don't discuss the great crises facing our country. So just forcing discussion on certain issues is enormously important. And, you know, John and I wrote a book, which is actually a very good book, if I must say so myself. And I've written several others. This one's better. And it's about uber capitalism. And what it talks about is the fact that we have a very, very small number of people who have incredible wealth and incredible power in our country and, in fact, throughout the world. And I think it is not an understatement to say that in America today we are rapidly moving toward an oligarchic form of society. Now, the problem is that we can't discuss that issue nationally, because the people who own the media are part of the oligarchy. Many of the members in Congress and other elected officials get their money from the oligarchy, and it's just something that we don't talk about. But if you think back over the last number of decades, we as a nation have made good progress, significant progress, in breaking down racial barriers. When I was a kid, I never thought we would have a black president in my lifetime. We've made progress there. We made enormous progress in breaking down sexism in this country. Not so many years ago, we had in the United States Senate 100 people, two women who were senators. And I think no one doubts that within a few years, half the Senate will be, or more, will be women, half the House will be women. But you see, and those are the progress. When I was a kid, I went to a very large high school in small town called Brooklyn, New York. And I think we graduated with 1,700 kids. And I have zero doubt that there were kids in my class and in my school who were gay. But they never came out. They kept that in. And there's been a revolution in that regard. So we as a nation, I think it is a people, should be proud of all of those accomplishments in creating a much less bigoted society. And I think young people don't appreciate what that struggle was about. And racial justice. Last night, I don't know if some of you were there, was in an event with Jesse Jackson, who is a great American hero. And Dr. King and all the rest who put their lives on the line to combat racism, and all those who fought for so long against sexism and homophobia, etc. But there is one issue not only where we are not gaining ground, we're losing ground, and that is the economic struggle. And that is an issue we don't talk about, and people feel uncomfortable talking about it. So women will get up and say, you know, we're going to control our own bodies. We all agree with that. African Americans are going to say, we're not going to be discriminated against. We all agree with that. Gay people say, no more discrimination, gay marriage, we're all for that. But out in the hinterland, you don't hear people say, I am a working class person. I'm working 60 or 70 hours a week, and I'm going nowhere in a hurry, and the likelihood is that my kids will be worse off than I am. And nowhere do you discuss, nowhere. Maybe, God knows, if I'm the only one or one or two others. See, it's a fact. You want to know why Trump has support all over this country from working class people? Over the last 50 years, despite a revolution in technology, right? 50 years. I was elected mayor of Burlington, Vermont in 81. We didn't have a computer, let alone cell phones and printers and all that stuff. And you didn't have robots in factories. There's been a radical increase in worker productivity. Guess what? Today, the average American worker in inflation adjusted for income is earning less than he or she did 50 years ago. Have you ever heard that discussion on television? So you want to know why people are angry. They have a right to be angry. They've seen their jobs go to countries where workers are paid a fraction of their wages. When they try to form a union, companies come in and fire workers, break the law, and they want to raise the minimum wage. You've got all these organizations telling us we can't raise the minimum wage, which remains, as you all know, abysmally in Washington, $7.25 an hour. Okay? People all over this country can't afford health care. 60,000 Americans die every year because they don't get to a doctor when they should. We pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, sometimes 10 times more than people in other countries. I took, years ago in Vermont, I took people from the northern part of Vermont into Montreal. They bought tamoxifen, which is a breast cancer drug, for one-tenth of the price. And just a few years ago, when I was running for president, we went from Detroit to Windsor, Ontario, about an hour drive, for insulin, one-tenth the price. We've got a healthcare system that is failing. Pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. We got real wages for workers lower today than it was 50 years ago. We have more income and wealth inequality today in America than we have ever had. You all know that? Not discussed. No one talks about it. You have three people on top owning more wealth than the bottom half of American society. And the corporate media and the political system hasn't told us that we're allowed to be outraged by that inequality. We can be outraged if some police officer shoots somebody. That's an outrage. We can be outraged if some woman doesn't get a job because of her gender. We can be outraged. But we cannot be outraged by the fact that tens and tens of millions of Americans in the richest country in the history of the world are living paycheck to paycheck. 60% of our people in the richest country in the history of the world living paycheck to paycheck. You're not allowed. That is not allowed. Outrage is not allowed. Media has and told us we're allowed to be outraged by that. So that's what our struggle is. And it's a big struggle because you're taking on the corporate class and their greed. You're taking on the oligarchy. You're taking on the corporate media. You're taking on the Democratic establishment. You're taking on the Republican establishment. Other than that, it's really quite easy. Now, the good news, after my wife always said I should hand out Prozac after my speech, is that right? Because I cheer people up, fill them with hope and optimism. The good news is that what we are seeing now is a rebirth and a revitalization of the trade union movement in America, which is a big deal. And one of the memories that I will carry with me for a long time is seeing Sean Fain of the UAW walk into a negotiating session with GM with a T-shirt that says, "Eat the rich." You know, but it's not just Sean. We're seeing a revitalization. The Teamsters getting a good contract. We're seeing young people at Starbucks all over the country. We're seeing people on college campuses organizing. And they're organizing, you know, really on a class basis. They're prepared to take on, you know, big money interest and go forward. So, you know, to my mind, where we are at this moment politically, obviously, is Trump has got to be defeated. And I trust I do not have to spend a lot of time on that issue in this audience. And I don't. I mean, you all know that. So it's, you know, but Trump is a different ball of wax. And what he has done is not just taken over and transformed the Republican Party. I don't think George W. Bush was invited to their convention to give a major speech. And that's not that party anymore. That used to be the party of the corporate elite and the billionaire class, and they've changed that. But what Trump has also done, which is incredibly dangerous, is not even that he lies all the time, is he lies in such a preposterous way that you can't even keep up with it. I mean, it takes a certain chutzpah, it does, to tell the American people who watch on live stream with their own eyes, thousands of people coming out to a Kamala Harris rally. Probably every major network was there covering the event. Hundreds of reporters were there reporting on the event, and Donald Trump says, nobody was there. The level of that insanity is really quite mind-blowing. But I'll tell you what the danger of it is. You know, we can laugh, and it is absurdly funny. But here's the danger. The danger is if you can convince some Americans, not most, that an event in which 10, 15,000 people came out never happened, that it was all artificial intelligence, it was all a myth. Trust me, in a close election in Wisconsin or Michigan, you can convince those people that it was rigged and fraudulent, right? That's the danger. So I think he lays the groundwork by trying to destroy every institution in America to say nothing is true. And the only truth that exists in America is from the words and the mouth of Donald Trump. And needless to say, that is what fascism is about. That's pretty dangerous stuff. So, you know, and this is a whole level. George W. Bush was a conservative Republican, not a fascist. So we're into a new realm, and we've got to figure out, you know, how we deal with it. But I think immediately where we have got to be, it goes without saying, that we have got to do everything that we can to defeat Trump and elect Kamala and Tim Walz. But we also have to understand that once they are elected, we need to continue our efforts to build in and strengthen the progressive movement. Because I will not tell anybody in this room, you will not be shocked to know that both political parties are significantly controlled by big money interests, right? You all know that. It's no great secret. And, you know, our job, you know, we did a poll recently, just that I'm going to close and sit down and chat with John. But a couple of weeks ago, my campaign paid for a poll, not to talk about individuals, but to talk about issues. So we asked the American people questions like, should we expand Social Security benefits by lifting the cap on taxable income? All right, which is now at $165,000. You lift that cap, you have millionaires starting to pay their fair share. We can raise Social Security benefits by $2,400 a year and extend the life of Social Security for 75 years. So we asked the American people, do you think that's a good idea? Over 70%, including a good majority of Republicans, said yes. I can't get that bill onto the floor of a democratically controlled Senate. We asked the American people, should we expand Medicare to include dental, hearing, and vision? Because a lot of seniors can't afford to go to a dentist. Overwhelmingly, over 70%, including a majority of Republicans, said, yes, we should. Not on the agenda. Too radical for them. Only 70% of the people support it. Because, why? Because the money didn't trust, do not support it. Okay? We asked that the people, should we raise taxes on the rich? Overwhelming support. Again, majority Republicans. So, you know, and it went on down the line. Should we raise the minimum wage to a living wage? Very strong support, including Republicans. So for a lot of reasons, you know, things happen. But it always comes back to money. And the people on top now, simple reality, have never, ever had it so good. Never. In the history of this country, the top 1% have never, ever had it so good. They like the status quo. They have significant control over both political parties. They own the media. They control the economy with more concentration of ownership than we have ever seen. So we got a lot of work to do to change that. But the good news is that, you know, what our poll showed, the support that the UAW got for their strike showed, the American people want us to take on the greed of the oligarchy. They do. So, with that, let me once again thank all of you. And I know many of you have been in the struggle for years. And, you know, we're winning some good battles, we're losing some battles, but the struggle continues. I mean, what we have been struggling, what we are struggling for, understand that one form or another people have been struggling for hundreds and hundreds of years. So let's continue the struggle. Thank you all very much for what you do.
We don't have a lot of time, and I want to quickly get into a couple of issues. And the last chapter of the book that Senator and I wrote is very relevant to PDA, because it is a chapter about all of the wonderful things about the Democratic Party. And actually not. It's a chapter on all the things that the Democratic Party needs to get right but doesn't always get right. And I think that's a good place for us to begin, Senator. We're at a convention of the Democratic Party. I know that you'll be speaking at that convention. But I also know that you have often argued that the Democratic Party has to rethink a lot of its approaches.
I mean, that's what the campaigns of 2016 and 2020 were essentially about. It was demanding that the Democratic Party open its doors to working class people, to young people, to people of color in a way that it hasn't done. Right, so I think if you go to the DNC, I don't know how many of you will be there, and John, you probably know more about this than I do. They got boxes over there on the top, right? So if you're not too late, you can get yourself a box. What is it, $1 million?
I think we're probably, with inflation, it's probably a little more now.
That's not a joke. How much is it? I don't know if anyone knows, but probably most of you have not purchased those boxes. But you're going to have all kinds of lobbyists, the big money interests floating all over the place. That's it. That is the reality. And one of the, you know, my keenest memories of the campaigns that we ran, 2020, we ran into COVID, but in 2016 is, you know, we had scheduled our events. Faz Shakir was helping me back there, somewhere back there. We had scheduled when the Democrats have their events in a statewide, they do statewide events, we would schedule rallies at the same day. So we would go to Denver or someplace, and 10,000 people, young people, you know, people of color, out to a rally, enormous energy. And then in the evening, you walk into a Democratic event, which is mostly a fundraising. You have a few hundred, mostly elderly white people. And the contrast was kind of day and night. It was clear. There was energy. And, you know, that's what we wanted to do, to bring that energy into the Democratic Party. And that energy obviously would come with an agenda that was a progressive agenda. The vast majority of the people in this country understand that health care is a human right. You tell me, is this current system broken or is it not? All right. So everyone knows. Doesn't matter what your politics is. We spend twice as much per capita. Our life expectancy is lower. There aren't enough doctors, nurses, dentists. The system is totally broken. Listen carefully. You're not going to hear much discussion about Medicare for All in the next couple of days. Insurance companies are pretty powerful. Drug companies are pretty powerful. And in fairness to Biden, who I have to say I've worked with very closely on a number of issues. And you know, when Biden was elected or after, during the campaign, he said he wants to be the most progressive president since FDR. And you know what? In many respects, he kept his word. So, you know, that's, you ask me about the Democratic Party, it's whether it's going to be a top-down party of people who have a whole lot of money, who are very good at manipulating media and doing all the things they do very well, or whether you have a grassroots party where people get their hands dirty and maybe not so articulate and go to Harvard or Smith, work for a living and live in the real world and want real change. That's the struggle, you know. And in Europe, it's a different world. And, you know, John, you probably, you know, John travels to Europe a lot, where they have coalition politics, where you have, we talked to the Minister of Education in Finland.
In Finland, yeah.
All right. You know, and they're in coalition. The Green Party is in coalition. Well, we can talk about it, but that's not what's happening here. As of now, you have a two-party system, and our job was to, and is, to do whatever we can to make, open the Democratic Party up and make it more progressive.
One of the things that you've done since you ran for, one of the things, when you ran for president, and I know this excites you a lot, an awfully lot of people were excited by the example. They decided to run as well. And we've talked a lot, we write about it in the book some, but we've talked a lot about this. I think you believe one of your greatest legacies is all these people that are running for office all over this country.
Well, not only who are running, but who have run and have won. That's right. And thanks for bringing that up. And it was, you know, good thing that Pramila was here, because the heart and soul of the Progressive Caucus that Pramila chairs is you got dozens. I mean, the media doesn't make a big deal about this, but you got dozens of wonderful, young, often people of color, members of Congress who, trust me, 30, 40 years ago, never, ever would have walked into, been able to get into Congress. And that is a revolutionary change. It's not just in Congress. It is in state legislature. Right here on city council, we got six socialists on the city council right here in Chicago?
Yes, at least. Yeah, yeah.
Hey. And New York State, I think, has, you know, a number of strong progressives, in California, certainly. So, yeah, you're right, John, in saying that that has been one of the success stories of what we have accomplished.
And one of the things that you've done is you have campaigned for people in primaries, and that has not always made you popular with everyone, but you have gone in to defend people who've been under attack. About a week and a half ago, you were up in Minnesota campaigning for Ilhan Omar as she ran for re-election up there, and that turned out pretty well, didn't it?
That turned out pretty well. But thank you for raising that issue. I mean, when we talk about money in politics, what you're seeing from AIPAC and other super PACs is simply outrageous. Jamal Bowman is the congressman from New York, in New York. Did a good job. Perfect? No. They spent, how much did they spend, John? 15?
I think it was about 12, 13 million.
$15 million to beat that guy because of his view on the war in Gaza and other issues. And they went after Cori Bush in Missouri as well, spending a whole lot of money. So, you know, one of the things that's bothered me, and I've raised this issue in the past, didn't get much resonance, is Democrats very often talk about the need to overturn Citizens United, which we all agree with, maybe move to public funding of elections, which we agree with. But at the very least, if you are serious about trying to control the power of money in politics within the Democratic Party, you can say, sorry, no super PACs allowed in primaries.
Again, we don't have a lot of time, but let me follow up on that. Obviously, you mentioned AIPAC. And one of the challenges for the Democratic Party has often been that while they're doing good stuff at the domestic level, they end up on the wrong side of the American people at the foreign policy level. And you've been very outspoken on this issue over the last few months.
I haven't, you know, dealing with 50 different other things, and I'm chairman of the Health Education Labor Committee, so I haven't had all that much time, but I have, you know, to the degree that I could. You know, if you think back, why don't you take a walk back in modern history? And we think, you know, people say 1968 Chicago. You all read about that, right? And who was right? The young people who were out demonstrating were right. And I think, and I speak both You know, that was my generation of young people. And my wife will tell you of friends of hers in her neighborhood who never came back. Kids who did not have a lot of money, drafted. And we all know not just the 59,000 people died, that millions of people, you think about it, in Vietnam. Think about what happened in Cambodia as an indirect result of it. What happened in Laos? Millions and millions of people. You know, by this, what was the domino theory? And then you think about this. Vietnam, terrible communism. China, terrible communism. And a few years later, these guys then enter into a free trade agreement with Vietnam and China. I mean, just think about the millions of people dead. 59,000 American kids dead. And God knows probably more after they came back hooked on drugs and the other terrible things that they faced. And then you go to the Gulf War. And then you go to the war in Afghanistan. And you go to the war in Iraq. Wrong, wrong, wrong. And today, maybe wronger, more wrong. Giving billions of dollars to this right-wing extremist, Benjamin Netanyahu, to do the most horrible things imaginable to the people of Gaza. Right? And that is all of those issues you got. This is, again, part of the money in politics. Don't kid yourself. And I remember one of the shining moments that I was proud of during a debate. I had a debate with Hillary Clinton, and she mentioned that Henry Kissinger was a dear friend and looked to him for advice. And I suggested that Henry Kissinger was a war criminal. A slight difference of opinion on that. But again, getting back to issues that we don't talk about.
Yeah.
Our foreign policy for many, many years has been wrong, not to mention the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile, not to mention so many other interventions on the wrong side. You know, and in fact, as I'm sure people in this room know, you know, we talk about Iran and Iran and Iran. What was it? What year did they overthrow, the CIA overthrew Mossadegh?
Mossadegh, yeah.
What year? 50, early 50s?
54, I think.
53?
53. There you go. You're with a crowd that actually has followed this very closely.
All right. So, again, you know, wrong side of history, and this is something needs discussion and needs change.
Let's talk about going from this into some of the kind of current moment of this campaign. We've just gone through a real radical transition in, you know, leadership of the Democratic Party, at least at the head of the ticket. A month ago, we thought we were going one direction. Now we have the first black woman who may be president of the United States, child of immigrants from India and from Jamaica. We have a governor of Minnesota who, whenever I turn on conservative TV shows and radio shows, they'd say, well, he's the Bernie Sanders of Minnesota. And I'm not quite sure of that. But there is a ticket running now that is, it's different than what we had. And what do you think about this moment that we're in, this moment of transition? It's difficult for a party, but it also seems to be very energizing.
Well, let me just, again, two things. I'm a little bit prejudiced here because I've known Joe Biden for a long time. And I do believe that he has been the most progressive president in the modern history of this country. He's a guy who did walk on a picket line with striking workers. And I can tell you, I don't want to bore you with the details of the American Rescue Plan and what we did in 2021 to try to get this economy back moving by giving people money put in their pockets. We lowered childhood poverty by 40%. We expanded unemployment benefits. We put more people onto Medicaid during that crisis any time in history, et cetera. And we lowered childhood poverty by 40%. All right? And he was prepared. I just want you all to know this, in fairness to the president. When we started work on what the consensus was, not the consensus, what some of us believed, all right, the American Rescue Plan was an emergency piece of legislation. And I'm familiar with it because I was then chairman of the Budget Committee and helped write it. It's a $1.9 trillion bill. Now, it was an emergency bill for a couple of years.
And I think we should point out that you actually did propose a somewhat larger bill.
Yeah, did. But then what we did is we said, okay, we've dealt with the emergency in a way I think that was very impressive. And now let's deal with the structural, the long-term structural problems facing America. And what I will tell you within the, well, what can I say, we're among friends here, is that Biden was prepared to spend, you know, talking about revolutionizing childcare, not going as far as I would like on healthcare as you would like, in terms of infrastructure. You name the issue. He was prepared to really bring about structural changes in this country. That was a Build Back Better, and we failed with two corporate Democrats in the Senate. But what I want you to understand, he was prepared to do that. He was prepared to go much further than any president since FDR. So we are where we are right now, and obviously John is right. Kamala, for a variety of reasons, has created, I think, a whole lot of excitement and energy. And clearly in the next 80 days or something, we got to do everything we can to make sure that she wins.
And one more question on Tim Walz. Have you talked with him? Do you have much contact with him? Tell us about your impression of Tim Walz, who I'm told is the Bernie Sanders of Minnesota.
Yeah, but that's just right-wing stuff, you know. It's the same people who invented Kamala Harris is even more radical than Bernie Sanders. That's on Fox about 20 times. That comes out of Trump's mouth 20 times a day. And in neither case is it true. Tim Walz is, unfortunately, but it's not. But what I like about Tim is that he is a very down-to-earth guy. And I think, he is a former school teacher. In fact, when we were in Minnesota, we were at the school that he taught at.
Mankato.
And he was a football coach and a veteran, you know, served in the National Guard there for 24 years or something. And I like it. And I think he's a straight shooter. He talks to working people. And his record as governor of Minnesota is a good record, given the very small margin that they had to work with in the Minnesota legislature. So I think it was a good pick. I was glad that that the vice president chose him. And I think we'll see where we go from here.
And you'll be out there campaigning for him.
We're off and running. We've been to many states already, and we'll continue to do
that. But need a ticket to go to a lot of these states. You were just going. I saw him about a month or so ago. Rainiest day ever in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Literally. It was just, it's torrential. And he's out, of course, Bernie Sanders had decided to do an outdoor rally. And people had come from all over central Wisconsin. And it was just a filled area. And right as he came to the stage, it literally started pouring. And I saw 750 people get drenched listening to Bernie Sanders, who, in great politeness, only delivered an hour-long speech. But let me close us off here with one last question. In the book, and this is something we're putting on your agenda for the future, in the book we talk a lot about the future of work and about who will control the future of work. And you will suggest not hear much about that at this convention,
right.
But it's an issue that has become a passion of yours because it really is a core question about who's going to control our economy.
Right. Let me just clue. I think Maxwell's coming up. Maxwell Frost.
Oh, is Maxwell here?
Where is he?
He's the youngest member of Congress.
Somebody is going to introduce him, but I did want to mention a moment ago I was talking about the very quiet revolution that we are seeing in the U.S. House, not in the Senate, but in the U.S. House, where a lot of young, smart, aggressive people are now winning election, and Maxwell is certainly one of those. So, all right, with that, let me thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Bernie Sanders.
In the era of the revitalization of the progressive movement, the youngest member of Congress elected from our movement and in recent generations, I don't know the long history and where you stack in terms of age. I'm sure you do. But again, the main point is, whatever his age, this is a person with a vision for an American society that we all want to live in. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
Progressives, how are we feeling? Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Alan. It's so good to be here with everybody today, and this is my first DNC ever. So I'm really excited to be here with our progressives today in a union hall, which is really exciting. My mom's a public school educator. She actually just retired. She taught special education for 37 years in public school. Now, yes, she retired, and now she's actually busier than she's ever been. She's a Moms Demand Action volunteer now, fighting to end gun violence. So I see my mom everywhere now. But everyone, it's so good to be here with you today. My name is Maxwell Frost. I'm proud to represent Florida's 10th congressional district in Congress, which is Orlando, Florida. I am a Florida man. I'm a proud Florida man. I used to tell people I'm from the great state of Florida. Now I tell people I'm from the beautiful state of Florida. We are a beautiful state with beautiful people. But listen, I got involved in politics when I was 15 years old for one simple reason. I didn't want to get shot in school. I went to an arts middle school and high school. I was a jazz drummer. My school didn't have a football team, so the jazz band, we were kind of the football team, you know? Before every jazz band concert, my best friends and I would go to this restaurant, load up on a ton of junk food where they're eating. This silence falls across the restaurant. We look at each other. We look around. We're like, what's going on? And we look at the television screens, and we see that somebody walked into an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, and murdered 20 children and 6 teachers. I was adopted at birth out of a really bad situation. I was raised in South Orlando. It's kind of like the white suburbs of Orlando. Gun violence wasn't really a thing on top of my mind as a kid. But seeing the images of those kids on that television that day really put me in a vulnerable state. And I ended up going to the show that night. I played like one of the worst concerts of my life because I kept looking behind me at the exit signs. I was scared somebody would walk in to that theater and kill my friends, family, and myself. I ended up going to D.C. for the memorial because I just felt like I needed to be there. So I came up when I was 15 to the memorial. And it was the night of the memorial that I got to meet a guy named Matthew Soto. His sister Vicky was a teacher at Sandy Hook. And when she heard the gunshots, she hid the class, all these kids, in the cabinets. And she was killed while she was doing that. And meeting a guy my age, or he was like a year older than me, meeting a 16-year-old with the demeanor of a 60-year-old crying over his sister who was murdered for just going to class changed everything about me. I mean, it broke me. And like I told you, my mom was a teacher. So I ran to my hotel room and I called my mom. I was like, Mom, I want to dedicate the rest of my life to making sure people don't have to feel that type of pain I saw in Matthew today. So then I end up going back to Orlando. I didn't know anything about organizing, so I started a petition at my school. I didn't know anything about policy either, so the petition literally just said, sign to end gun violence. It didn't have like a policy or anything, sign to end gun violence. I got hundreds of signatures, and then again, I had never organized before, so I didn't know who to give it to, so I brought it over to my principal and gave it to my principal, who looked at me like, we'll get on that. He probably threw it away. But I bring this story up because it was the first time in my life I had ever identified a problem and then seen the people around me as part of the solution. And that's what it means to be an organizer. I'd continue to organize all throughout high school, out of high school. I'd begin to organize on Amendment 4, which was the ballot initiative to get people with previous felonies the right to vote in Florida. And we won in expanding voting rights. Then I went to go work at the ACLU, the National ACLU, where I ran a program called Rights for All in South Carolina, where we bird-dogged presidential candidates to ask them where they were on civil rights and civil liberties. And in fact, one of the people that I got a video of, do you all know what bird-dogging is? Yeah. All right, so when you go up to somebody with a video camera, you ask them a question, and it's not really about like that question by itself, it's about asking the same question over a period of time and seeing how they develop on the issue. So I'm with a volunteer. She was 77 years old, named Nina Gray in South Carolina. And we saw that at the time, Vice President Joe Biden was going to be speaking. And at the time, he was actually for the Hyde Amendment, which is something that keeps abortion access from poor working class women, women of color, people of color. So we go up, we ask the question, and then he says, yes, I'm for abolishing the Hyde Amendment. And we look at each other, we're like, we're breaking news, this is crazy. So the ACLU posts the video,
Everyone's really excited about it. And then the next morning, the campaign puts out a statement saying the president, vice president, misheard the question. And he was actually for the Hyde Amendment. But what this did was it brought it to the surface. Everybody started talking about it. The next debate, if you remember, a lot of the time of that debate was based on the Hyde Amendment and the answer that, at the time, Vice President Biden gave. And everyone came out and said, you cannot be for the Hyde Amendment and be a Democrat. And a few weeks passed, and the president thought about it. And he came out and gave a really heartfelt address where he said, I've been wrong. And he changed his position. And then he became the president. And I bring that up because sometimes, we all know politics can be really confusing. Things can take a long time to get done. But in organizing, sometimes all it takes is like your voice, creativity, a freaking cell phone, and you can have an impact on what the leader of the free world thinks on a very important issue. Being a progressive is, yes, about our ideology and what we believe, right? So there's something Pramila Jayapal always says that I love. She says, if politics is about the art of the possible, then being a progressive is just about stretching what is possible. But it's not just about what we believe. It's also about how we fight for it. And that is why we believe in grassroots organizing. That's why we believe in holding our leaders in account. That's why we believe in going out and speaking with our communities directly, no matter who you are, validating their concerns. Because when I think about the issue that got me involved in politics, which is gun violence, I always tell people most gun violence are crimes of condition. People who have been pushed to the brink and feel like they need to use the gun to get ahead. But the goal here should be creating a world where people don't feel the need to use a gun to solve their problems in the first place. So if you want to end gun violence, guess what? You better be for Medicare for All. If you want to end gun violence, you got to be for fighting the climate crisis. If you want to fight gun violence, you got to be for making sure we have livable, thrivable wages, that we defeat poverty. That's how we end gun violence. It's not the issue in and of itself, it's the symptom of root causes. And we all understand that for generations, the right wing, and yes, even many Democrats, would sell people this lie and run on a politics of scarcity. That there's not enough. That if you get something, I must be losing something. That's not true. In the richest country on earth, there is enough for all of us to thrive, for everybody to have what they want to have, for everybody to have health care, everyone to have a good paying job, everybody to have housing as a human right. I'll end with this. This agenda at the end of the day is just about loving our people. You'll hear me say this again in the future. But when I think about the fact that the right likes to claim like they own patriotism, for them, patriotism is a damn slogan on a hat, bald eagle, beer, and flag. It's like a vibe. For us, patriotism is about loving the people who live in this damn country and fighting for them every single day, no matter who they are. That's what it means to love somebody. When you love somebody, you want them to be healthy. You want them to have housing. You want them to live free of gun violence. You want them to be able to live their lives. That is what this movement is about. That's why I'm proud to be a progressive. I'm proud to be a progressive elected in the state of Florida. And we don't discount the South. Our progressive movement is rising up. You see young people all across the South rising up. God bless y'all. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, PDA, for being one of the first organizations to endorse me when I ran against 10 other people for Congress. Let's win a better world for everybody. Thank you, guys.
And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank Alan Minsky, Progressive Central, and speakers Pramila Jayapal, Bernie Sanders, John Nichols, and Maxwell Frost. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, to producer, director, engineer Melissa Figueroa, editor Juliana Gotha, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. click Audio Archives, and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Suzy Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Suzy Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Suzy Wiseman.